All righty, here we go. A lot of news to get to. Can't wait to hear from Tom. Let's get Tommy in here. Tom. There you are. Sorry about that. I didn't know where you were. Get all panicky. You okay? Tom?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I actually hit two buttons simultaneously. The one that opens your door, and then someone was walking down the stairs. It threw me off. I was completely
That's right.
Diving in!
Andrew lives in the basement, not me.
Right. Oh, Andrew in the basement. God love him. All righty. This is not a news story. In fact, I said to Jacob while I was looking at this one that's Cairo 7 and Como and King and everybody did it. Q13, they all did it. Gary Horker read through, 170-some pages of information that had been coming in from all the police that were leaving.
175 pages of exit interviews.
Yeah. This is the exact same story, I looked it up, that was done August 2, 2019. Exact same thing. There was the anchor standing there, or the reporter standing there, holding a big pile of papers talking about why people were leaving. And this story Jason Rantz did saying, expect more to start happening, more people to be leaving next year. I think this, what happened in CHOP, just sort of accelerated all of it. Did you get a chance to enjoy some of the stories that had come from Cairo 7 and King and Q13 and everybody else?
Yeah, I mean, I read through the exit interviews. Yeah, what it does is it accentuates what we had been hearing rumblings of. Now we have the actual exit interviews that are similar. What's funny is that if that was true a year ago, this was before the whole Black Lives Matter protest and the upset. So cops were unhappy with the supposed, you know, wonderful police force that we had under the DOJ decree. People even back then were unhappy, and then things got worse. I think a lot of people think just recently things have gotten so bad that people are leaving in droves for the cause.
So I wanted to find out what was the impetus or the linchpin on that one was it was Shama Sawant referring to them as murderers, and generally the overall feeling the city council seemed to have towards the police and the police towards the city council. The main reason they were leaving July and August of 2019, of the 48 that they read through at Cairo 7, it was primarily the city council doesn't support us. The mayor doesn't have our back. We don't feel as if we are appreciated and we're constantly being second guessed. So this problem is not new. It was just accelerated and got a chance to experience the mass exodus that people have been saying
going
is coming.
Over 175 pages of exit interviews with more than 100 SPD officers stating their reasons for leaving, we saw the same handwritten complaints, often including the same phrasing again and again about Seattle city leadership. One cop wrote, quote, "I refuse to work for the socialist city council and their political agenda. It ultimately will destroy the fabric of this one fine city." Another cited an unwinnable battle with the city council. It will be the downfall of the city of Seattle. Another cop on his way to another police department said, "The city's morals do not match my own." Almost every officer who is leaving for another law enforcement job said they feared losing their jobs here. One saying, quote, "The people who run the department have to be politicians and work with people who hate us." The head of SPD's union called it
deflating. Seeing was what I still believe is a great department being torn apart by politics.
Some officers cited safety as the reason for leaving. Quote, "If staff is cut, officers will be responding without adequate backup, and it will be either unsafe for officers or unsafe for civilians who are waiting even longer for assistance."
When you immerse politics into public safety, you sacrifice human beings, the good men and women that do the job of policing. They're going to leave.
When asked if they would ever consider working for SPD again, one outgoing cop said this, quote, "If the political climate stabilizes and a more supportive council comes into play, I would love to return home as an officer."
This is not a new story. Here we go. This is last year.
These 42 exit interviews of Seattle police officers have a lot in common. Parting words praise the camaraderie among officers, some even applauding their direct supervisors. But a common complaint that popped up over and over again is about city politics. Officers who say they feel a lack of support from city council.
It doesn't come as a surprise that they left, but it makes it all the more frustrating because I could see it coming.
Brendan Golding recognizes some of the names in these exit interviews because last year he was a sergeant with SPD.
We can't hire officers as fast as they're leaving.
Golding says recruiting officers is hard in any city, but especially so in Seattle.
Having a city where the city council does not appear friendly to the police, doesn't even really appear to want police officers doing their job, certainly doesn't help.
So not a new problem, Tom.
Well, I mean, I suppose it is a new problem because a year ago, there wasn't even any discussion of defunding the police. We were on, projected plans to hire more and more. It wasn't until this George Floyd protest this summer that the defund police and the 50% defund the police movement got any traction, and it got traction with the city council. So if these people a year ago, about half of them, 42 out of the 110 now this year, thought the city council wasn't as supportive, I mean, they're really going to feel that way now.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm saying that the problem isn't new in that the police don't feel support from the city council. They don't like the city council. They don't feel the mayor has their back. They were leaving last year, and they're leaving this year. They're just leaving at a faster rate to get out of here. Here's what the mayor has
to say. Both Chief Diaz and I are very concerned at the number of officers that have left. One of the things that's most concerning to me as mayor is we're starting to lose the officers who are the exact officers we want to keep. Those younger officers who are new in the force, they came on under the consent decree. They've been trained in de-escalation and crisis intervention. They're diverse, and those officers are starting to leave because they see better opportunities somewhere else. I say to the ones that are there, please stay. Seattle values you. I value you.
Okay.
Well, she's the mayor.
Better opportunities somewhere else? Right. They see better opportunities somewhere else? No, they don't want to work for you. They don't want to work for the city council, and they don't want to work for you. It's because they don't want to work for you.
But I would make a distinction between the mayor and the city council, because after all, the mayor was the one that vetoed the 50% defunding business. Now, the fact that her veto was overridden is, beside the point in terms of the mayor and Diaz and, at the time, Carmen Best. So, but we do have,
Tom,
the thing is that this is... This is a clash. It makes perfect sense. We've got a lot of people in Seattle that think that the police are not up to snuff, and so they're going to be critical of how much money we've spent on the police department because it has ballooned over the last few years, and other facilities, other city functions haven't. And so there's a natural clash between the citizenry that doesn't want so much money spent for the cops and call it militarization and all of that, and the people that actually are serving as the police force, and they feel disrespected. Imagine if suddenly Bonneville just told all the talk show hosts, okay, listen, you're going to have to live by these standards, not those standards. These weren't the standards that we were hired under. We might object and say, wait a minute, really? And then say, well, that's what we want. And then we'd leave in droves, or we would adapt, as we saw fit.
If we were insulted on a daily basis, if the integrity of the character of you or I was questioned constantly in the press by elected officials, by people that really have power publicly, and creating an animosity between, we'll go back to the original, which is the police and the city council, and then the people that they're serving are being told that they are horrible people, that the police are horrible people. So there's sort of a trust that's a mistrust that's injected directly into the system because of the city council. So it has nothing to do with the de-policing. And the mayor basically allowed the East Precinct to go. Remember, we watched that really awkward press conference when somebody asked Carmen Best, Chief Best, about, you know, whose decision was it? And she made it very clear it was not mine. And then she went on and she did a video talking to all of her officers saying, listen, I've got your back, basically saying the mayor doesn't. This was the summer of love. The mayor talking about vetoing the 50% cut. Of course, anybody could veto. A second grader would realize that you don't need to. You can't cut by 50%. Crime in most major cities where police have left votes? Has gone up.
It got. What do you mean? Anybody could defund the police 50% veto a defund.
Anyone would be smart enough. Any mayor would be smart enough to know that you cannot defund the police by 50%.
But
a second grader could realize, hey, well, let me get this straight. If I cut the salary, if we cut the police by 50%, that won't be good, the second grader would say. The mayor realizing that's not a good move, and she even said to them, what's your backup plan? Okay, you've come out with the idea you want to just cut by 50%. What's the plan behind it? They had no plan behind it. But you know what? The people get the government they deserve. Anyone
that's
listening right now to the Tom and Curley Show that votes for those city council members, this is the city that you have chosen because these are the people you have chosen to represent you.
That's right.
So this is anyway, it. So I guess people are like, I like this. If they're a Seattle resident, maybe you, Tom, I don't know who's in your district. You voted for him. Do you like what has happened? Do you like Mosqueda? Like, who'd you vote for? Who's in your district? Who represents you?
It was the guy, Dan Strauss, I think.
Okay.
Who replaced Mike O'Brien. But yeah, you're proving my point for me in that it took, in order to override a veto from the mayor's office, you need 7 votes. They got 7 out of 9 votes to override it. So it was it did take some political courage on Durkin's part to veto it. If she's arguing in favor of reforming the police and working under the consent decree, so that's the big distinction. But you're right. There is the cops that are unhappy. I understand why they're unhappy. But if the citizenry of Seattle want the cops to act differently than they want to act, that's going to be a natural clash. And if they, you know, leave, it's a good sort of a power move. I thought when Carmen Best left, fine, you don't want me, I'll leave. It's a power move on the cops part. And we'll see if the citizenry of Seattle likes that or not. Remember, it was a year ago, 2 years ago when they had the big council elections. And everyone thought, oh, boy, now we're going to throw Shamasawand out. We're going to show all of those, you know, left-leaning progressives and socialists that, you know, the what for. And Amazon ran an entire, and the Chamber of Commerce ran an entire slate of candidates, and almost all of them lost. So the city of Seattle voted for an even more left-leaning progressive council.
So we do get an idea, we just get a little glimmer of what it's like to have a small section, let's say 6 blocks, what it would be like to have 6 blocks and no police. And I think in about a 2-month span, we had, was it 3 shootings or 4 shootings? Was it 5 shootings? I know it was 2 deaths. So in less than two months, in a 6 block span, we had 2 deaths and a number of shootings. We had some arson. This is a no police zone. No police are allowed in there. So that's what it feels like. So that's what the city of Seattle, I would assume most of the people that are talking to the city council members are activists and they're mob. This is the mob rule. So the mob has come in and determined we don't want police. 50% of them, get rid of them altogether. They're all horrible people. Don't forget, all cops are bastards. Somebody give me an aluminum bat so I can strike one in the back of the head with a full swing from a 19-year-old. What's it take for a 19-year-old from Kirkland to get so completely brainwashed to believe a bat at a police officer is doing something for the greater good of what?
I don't know, John. You're the East Sider, not me. I think that this is what's happening. That right now we have people that feel like that they are being mistreated. And I don't, when you say the mob, The mob, this is a democratically elected. This wasn't a mob that elected the city council. It was the
citizens. The mob runs now. The mob runs it now, Tom. The activists run it. The mob.
What do you
talk the average person living somewhere in, you think the average person living in Queen Anne wants 50% reduction of police or would be happy about this story? I would tell you right now that most people that want more police, if most minority communities want more police, not less police. So I'm sure they're not happy about this.
The most recent poll, local poll I saw, I think it was Crosscut, but I could be wrong, maybe Elway or something. They said that 54% of Seattleites think the Seattle Police Department needs reform, but 58% did not think that defunding the police was the way to go. So that's the balance, and that's the balance of the tension that's going on between the mayor's office and the city council right now, is that, yes, Seattleites are liberal and progressive and think, if we can reform police even more, we're good with the DOJ consent decree, and if we can, raise that level even higher, we're for that. Maybe take less money devoted to cops by giving cops less to do and put it into social services. Seattleites support that, but they don't support defunding the police. And that's why the tension right now.
Yeah. The Crosscut poll, the 54% to say that, to reorganize the police or something. I don't put much credence in that because you just sit there and you watch and listen. It's everything's cops, 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 cops. And that's all you get. It's the same great study that was done during France. In France, when a couple of attacks had occurred, and what's the number one problem facing France right now? Islamic terrorism. Well, that's not the number one problem facing France, but those are the stories that were most relevant in the person's mind. So that's what they respond to. I would dismiss the 54%. So you come back a year later, they wouldn't probably say that. I would say the people that are victims of crime, that experience it every single day, those are the people whose stories matter. That's the poll you should take. What more cops or less cops? Those people that really need to call the cops because they are the ones being victimized by criminals. But
this
is interesting. So the cops leave. Yep. What's that?
The 54%, though, are the people that voted the city council in. They probably got about 54-55% of the vote. The question is the city council now ahead of the citizenry? And if they are, then elections will rebalance that. It didn't happen last time.
Homicide rate and lack of cops. Any connection?
Not necessarily, because it's happening across the country.
And cops are leaving across the country.
Well, maybe. I mean, but that's a different, I think in our case, it's a different situation. If that's the truth across the country, then it's not really a Seattle problem. I was thinking it was more specific to Seattle, but yeah.
Here we go. Which was extra annoying, not only the words coming out of my mouth, but the tone tenor of my voice through the crappy phone that I'm working with right here now, Tom. Sorry about that. Keel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL. Keel Mortgage, the best in the business. The ongoing saga of Nicole, Dory's producer. She's got the condo, Tom. She paid about $8,000 more than the listing price.
Ouch.
But I know, ouch is right. But that's the case for everybody. But she said Keel Mortgage helped her with it every step of the way. And I gave her a raise. And yeah, but that's the kind of guy I am. And then I realized, holy moly, how am I going to make payroll next month? I haven't made any money, so I'm going to need you to help me out, Tom.
Checks in the mail, John.
By the way, are you receiving, you can start to get Social Security, can't you?
Yeah, I'm over 62, but I'm not.
No. Let's talk about the fact that now with COVID-19 and people working from wherever they want to work, that they've decided they want to live wherever they want to live. So big cities, New York, San Francisco, right? People are leaving and going other places. Saw a really fun piece. A bunch of people leaving San Francisco going to Boise. People in Boise hate them and want them to go back. Or generally the idea is if you left that city because you didn't like that city, don't bring the stuff that you didn't like to where you are now moving to.
I love this article. Yeah, it's about, okay, so let's imagine this post-pandemic world where people can work remotely and live in far-flung places like Cleellum and still work on a Seattle radio station if they want. Where would people end up working and living and wanting to live? Now, I'm still, I still think that most people that are leaving places like San Francisco and New York and L.A. are probably leaving because the price of everything is so high.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
You know, it, all things being equal, I'm not sure that people would rather live in Topeka than, say, you know, beautiful San Francisco. But things aren't equal, and so your dollar goes a lot farther. If indeed everybody can live wherever they want to live and are able to work remotely, which isn't everybody, but it could be like half the populace, where do people end up and show up? And right now, a lot of people are leaving the big cities and going to smaller towns. What I found fascinating about this is, so, I mean, ideally, that would be great. Everybody could live where they, if you really like, you know, the arid, desert plains, you know, that might be your kind of a milieu. If you like the water, if you like the mountains, I mean, anybody can live wherever they want. Where would they live? What I found fascinating was the geographical breakdown of politics. That what conservatives want and what liberals want are very different. And what this might end up doing. So they, I don't know if this struck you, but they talked about what conservatives want. They want to live in a big house in a small town and rural area, ideally with people with the same faith. So big house, small town, rural, and same faith. Liberals tend to go for smaller houses, but walkable communities in cities, which obviously are more urban, with preferably with a mix of different races and ethnicities. Yeah. And so they suggest
the same
then,
faith.
Go
but
ahead.
They want the same faith. The faith is their religion.
Well,
is
the
government.
Same values.
Their religion,
values.
That's a little different. Their faith is their faith is government and that faith. So.
Okay.
So that's what they want to be surrounded by people that worship the same thing they worship.
Okay, yeah. Half of consistent conservatives and 35% of consistent liberals say it's important to live in a place where most people share their political views. So that's another thing that's kind of reassuring. People want to live where they feel like they're part of that community, at least, especially more so maybe with conservatives than liberals. But what I found great about that is in some ways, everybody can live wherever they want to live. That's good. But this article suggests that if we really did that, we might be siloing ourselves even more. Because if all the conservatives live in these seven, you know, states or seven cities or whatever, and all the liberals live there, that it might actually be less kind of communal as a country than it is even now when everyone thinks it's so polarized.
My father told me a story when he was working at IBM. He had just gotten a job there, and it was either hired IBM. They wanted to do something that had never been done before. They wanted to do early results, and they wanted IBM to tabulate it all so that you would be able to say, you know, at this point, CBS is calling Pennsylvania for, you know, Kennedy. So because television now is going to get those things out there. So the research that was done to University of Pennsylvania and IBM found the professor said you need to go into a neighborhood and talk to, if there's 200 homes, you only need to talk to five people to get some idea of how that entire neighborhood voted. Now, this is a time when you would have very parochial cities, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, that you knew, well, those are all the Russians live there.
Right.
And all the Italians live here, right? And all the Jews are here, and the Catholics are here, and the Blacks are here. And you only need to talk to five homes out of every single one of those in order to get a pretty good idea of how they voted. Right? Mm-hmm. Then they realized, the guy said, not just, you know, that you could expand it out and say 300 homes, five out of the 300 would give you a pretty good idea of how people voted. I think people end up, like, for instance, so I'm living in Clear Elum. Lace and the kids are back in Sammamish, coming back and forth. And when I'm there in Clear Elum, the reason I want to be there is I get a greater sense of, nothing against my neighbors in Sammamish. I know more about my neighbors now in just 2 months than I have living 10 years in Sammamish.
That's really interesting because, yeah, you've always been anti-neighborly. Because I know my neighbors, you know, I don't know intimately, but pretty well, and, you know, recognize them, talk to them, know their names. But you were always like, nobody does that. I think it's great if Clear Elum has brought that neighborliness out in you.
I love being on TV for all those years. People, did you like that? I said it made the world a really small place, which is what I liked. You go to the supermarket and people know you and talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have. And the fact that people look out for one another. Dougie, my neighbor, comes over and helps me, you know, with different odds and ends because he's got all these tools and all I got to do is pay him in beer. The other day he came in and dug up a huge trench. It was 48 inches deep and it went all around the back, like almost a half an acre. What do I owe you? You owe me beer. And I went and I bought him $250 worth of Coors Light. His garage looked like an end cap at Safeway. But the thing is, I know him and I know Marla and Dick. I think when you're out there and winter is coming, it's supposed to snow on Friday. There's a sense of like everybody's getting ready for it. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. I can't explain it, but I think that's what it is about a small town like that.
So I guess the question for you is, you always used to mock me because we do Neighbors Night Out, you know, it's like the first Tuesday of August or something where the neighbors on your block get together. You always scoffed at that. Do you think Cleellum observes that? And if so, would you join in this time?
They won't. They do Neighbors Night Out every night.
I there you go. Okay, good.
I sit in Dougie's driveway and drink beer with him and shoot guns and then burn a big, huge piles of wood and paper.
By the way,
does
he really go by Dougie, or are you just using that to minimize him?
No, he goes by Dougie.
Okay.
Which is weird because he doesn't look like a Dougie, and he's replaced the article "the" for the F word. I have never heard anybody curse as much as him. Maybe Andrew, who produces the G and Ursula show, he could give Dougie a run for his money with the F-bombs. It is
really
amazing, amazing use of the F-word.
All right, then.
I don't know if there's a competition for it, but we could try. We'd be able to broadcast it. All right, Tracy Taylor, what's going on out there where you are? There are some good teachers that know that it's an extreme, almost virtually impossible for a child to try to learn online without having the interaction of other kids and having the teacher be present and having the feedback. I think society, American society, will certainly be at a great disadvantage in because kids are experiencing school now. So some teachers are stepping way up and breaking out an instrument, Tom, that I know you know something about, in order to keep the kids a little bit more focused.
That's right. Nice profile in the Seattle Times about this one particular teacher, Mr. Escobedo, a 30-year public school veteran who teaches music and band at Eckstein Middle School. He noticed he can tell. So imagine music. I mean, that's one of those hard classes to teach when you're doing everything virtually, and so the live interaction is one thing. Mostly he has his students produce things that they send him, like 250 like videos that ends up going through and critiquing of their performing. But one of the things that he notices when kids are engaged, they allow their picture of themselves to show up on these you know, Zoom like kinds of meetings, and when they're not really engaged, they're still there supposedly, but you can't see them. And he noticed that the one time where everybody zoomed in and was on live is when he started demonstrating the didgeridoo, which is this long tubular instrument from Africa. And I the only reason I know about this is because my brother is a music major and he ended up learned how to play a didgeridoo. And that really brought kids' attention. So I'm hoping the main reason we can do this story is to sing the praises of teachers everywhere, but also hear a little didgeridoo music so you get a sense of what it sounds like.
Wait a minute. Wait. That's not just one instrument.
That's one guy by himself. It's like
really?
It's some type of French didgeridoo competition, so they were all very competent. But it's one guy.
So, by the way, it's Australia, not Africa. Aboriginal peoples of Northern Australia that were the ones that developed it. It's an amazing sound, and you have to learn this thing called circular breathing, which a lot of people may do in various guises. But this is, you have to get this, and that is like top notch didgeridoo playing. I don't
know.
Let's
hear your burr. Good.
Yeah.
Brr.
Brr. It sounds better, but I haven't mastered circular breathing.
Kenny G, where'd he go to school? He knows circular breathing.
Yeah, I bet he does.
He is in the Guinness Book of Records for holding one note for like 28 minutes long or something there with his little Kenny G horn there.
That was his first, third, circular and seventh album.
So I'm always worried about you. You seem like low energy today, but then you pull that one out of nowhere. Good job on that one there. You all right? You sound down. I know I sound a little robotic.
Well, I know.
Are you tired?
I am nervous because I feel like you are going to go away any second, and I'm holding on. That's kind of, I'm doing circular breathing inside my heart.
Okay. What then we do, we're going to throw to Tracy Taylor at some point, and then I'm going to run and try to find a better place so that you don't have to do that circular breathing through your heart again, okay?
That would be great.
All right, good. All right, so let's take care of Tracy, and I'll try to find a new spot so that I don't sound all weird and, well, weird as far as tonality, but the general weirdness of my thoughts will still
be coming out
of my mouth,
though.